Aloha, party people. You are listening to Inside the Desert Oasis Room, episode number 35. This episode is sponsored by Tanduay Rum. Established in the Philippines in 1854, Tanduay is the world's largest rum producer and winner of over 170 international medals in the past four decades, including Brand of the Year in London's World Branding Awards Rum category from 2015 to 2017, and Rum Brand Champion of the World by thespiritsbusiness.com in 2015. As sponsor of the Inside the Desert Oasis Room podcast and the toast to Master Ninja Ray Buen at the legendary Tiki Tea in Los Angeles, California, Tanduay Rum is the perfect companion to celebrate all things tiki. For more information, check out their webpage at tanduayus.com or follow them on Facebook or Instagram at tanduayusa. This podcast is also sponsored in part by the Royal Hawaiian. Founded in Laguna Beach, California in 1947, the Royal Hawaiian is South Orange County's premier tropical drink and dining destination. Come try their signature cocktail, the Lapu Lapu, a delicious combination of tropical fruit juices with a generous float of dark spirits, or other island-inspired favorites like ahi tuna poke or the dynamite crab-crusted mahi mahi. Enjoy their delicious brunch or drop in for happy hour from 2:30 to 5:30 p.m. daily for drink specials and more. To make a reservation, visit RoyalHawaiianLB.com. On this episode, we drop by Bosco's Kapu Tiki Room, Bosco's home tiki bar space built back in the early 1990s. If you don't already know who Bosco is, and you should, well, let me give you a little bio. He was one of the first, if not the first, urban archaeologists of tiki and Polynesian pop, starting back in the mid-1980s. Most people had forgotten about these grand old places, and most didn't really care about them anymore. So back then, thrift stores, swap meets, and antique malls were chock full of vintage tiki and mid-century decor, much of it coming from Polynesian and tiki-themed palaces that no longer exist today. Bosco's story is unique in that, being one of the first urban archaeologists of tiki and Polynesian pop, he really had no influences other than himself and what he thought was cool. He was probably the first person in the revivalist era to build a home tiki bar space, the Kapu Tiki Room, which inspired his design of Tabu Cove, the first real tiki bar in the revivalist era, formerly located at the Venetian in Las Vegas. He was also one of the first to start a tiki mug collection, and from what we can gather, the first person to start making tiki mugs in the revivalist era. If you like hearing stories of what all these old tiki and Polynesian pop palaces were like before they were shut down, the efforts he went through to save some of the historic pieces and many of them, and what it was like to start his now thriving tiki and mug making business, then I think you'll enjoy this episode. Bosco had tons of stories that he wanted to share, so much that we just couldn't record them all, but I expect that we'll do another episode in the future. For now, make yourself a cocktail, kick back, and listen to how this modern-day tiki movement that we all enjoy got started.
Inside the Desert Oasis Room.
Well, yeah, people do get very passionate about with the tiki thing.
That.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just so misunderstood.
Yeah. Cultural appropriation, I think, is what you're getting at.
Well, no. Yeah, it's cultural appropriation, yes. But there's a whole other aspect to it as well. It's not
right,
just that part
right.
of it. They think that you should not be allowed to create those things. We had a kid, he wrote from Hawaii, and the final in the art class was to make a tiki. And then I don't know who got on their hind legs, some of the parents saying that you can't do that. And
oh, really?
He wrote me this long letter asking me, are they doing something wrong? And is it okay to do that and all this? And then it got in the paper over there. And I had to tell him, no, it's cool. It's not what these people think that is. That's not what it is. You know, they're looking at it like a Westerner looks at religion.
Yeah.
And then putting that over that. And that's not how it worked.
Yeah.
They don't get that.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. Well, hey, thanks for sitting down with the podcast.
Yeah, it's great. Thanks for coming out.
Man, I've been wanting to sit with you for a while now, and I have all kinds of questions to ask you. And this all goes back to the early days of the Polynesian pop revival. And why don't we just start at the very beginning with you going to Art Center. You went to Art Center in the 80s?
Yes, mid-80s.
Okay.
I left here, Escondido, to go to Art Center.
Oh, you did? Okay. So, I don't know why I was under the impression that you were from San Gabriel Valley.
I was.
Okay, you were.
We had lived there until about 76.
Okay.
And then we moved here from 76 to 80, whatever it would have been, 4, I think, when I moved back.
Okay.
5. And so I moved back to San Gabriel Valley to go to Art Center.
Okay. And what was your original plan by going to Art Center? What were you thinking of studying or doing in the future?
When I went there, what my degree was for illustration. Because
graphic illustration, advertising?
They didn't break it down like that. They had graphics. Graphics was a different department. That was a different degree. You could, I don't want to get too technical, but it was just illustration, like painting.
What were you thinking of doing with that?
To book covers, just whatever illustrators did back then.
Right.
You know? And I started thinking, well, when I started, I realized I wanted to learn how to paint. Because although I could paint proficiently, you know, when I was in junior college, you're kind of faking it the whole time because you don't really have that education, how to draw. And so I wanted to get that basis, like a bedrock.
So you were painting in junior college?
Yes.
Were you doing that from an art class or were you doing that
classes,
on your own?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're saying that they just don't delve into it the same way they do at art school.
You know, it was probably me. I was probably not interested in that end of it. I wanted to get like finished paintings done and I didn't have time to go sit and do a drawing in a drawing class.
What kind of stuff were you painting?
I'll show you later. Remind me. I got one in the shop. It's a really nice airbrush thing. It was like a punk rock. Not punk rock. A new wave kind of a deal.
Okay.
It was whatever I was into at the time.
At the time, yeah. So it was really just more like modern. What's the word I'm looking for?
I wish I could push a button and show you, and then you go, oh.
Yeah.
it looked like California new wave art. I mean, it had just had everything on it that I liked at the time. It was checkers. It was a ex-girlfriend. Gosh, I can't even remember. It's in the shop. We'll look at it later.
All right. So it's 80s. Period influenced.
Yeah, it was influenced by Japanese illustration, which was like really hyper realism back then. My dad was working in Century City for those guys that ran Heaven. It was this shop. It was all that kind of new wavy kind of stuff. It was all 50s retro stuff. And they knew I wanted to be an artist, so they would send these books back with my dad. Yeah. And it was these Japanese illustration books. And it was like they did these hyper real, like, they'd render a vat full of coffee beans or something, and it looked like a photograph.
Oh, okay. I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I was thinking more of the stuff like Soriyama.
No.
He did the robotic models.
Yeah.
And then there was, I think Nagel Japanese?
No, I don't believe he was.
Okay. So I'm wrong about that. It seemed very Asian influenced, though.
Yeah, clearly.
Okay. So I was thinking more when you say, like, you know, period to that time, yeah. Japanese, that's what came to my head. So
that's what we would all, my dad would bring them and we would all, like, my friends and I would go, wow.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty cool. I think that's pretty interesting that you started out doing that kind of art because that's not what you're known for today.
No, I mean, it goes back even further into high school. I was into it. I always wanted to draw.
And that was the same kind of styles, whatever you were influenced
evolved,
by at the time.
You know, yeah, whatever you liked at the time.
Yeah. I want to jump into the whole tiki thing, because I've largely credited you as being the first urban archaeologist or tiki urban archaeologist here in Southern California. I believe that there was like a small group of people doing this, but as far as I know, you were the first revivalist carver. You were the first revivalist mug maker. What drew you to all that?
Now you're making me blush. I mean, much of what you say is true, although it's incorrect. I was not the first urban archaeologist.
Okay.
So I don't know who that would be. Everybody I met early on, Sven and Jeff, they had been doing this on their own before they met each other. There was a bunch of people, Otto, Doug. I'm leaving out a few people's names, but everybody was on the same track, but they did not know each other. We were all working independently of each other. So we were all looking for tiki stuff, and we were all looking for old buildings. At the time I fell into the urban archaeology thing, I was in college, living with my friend Mark, was my roommate, and we started driving, because we were back in my old neighborhood where I grew up.
And I want to clear up, Mark, when you talk about Mark, your roommate, we're talking about Mark Ryden.
Yes, Mark Ryden.
Mark Ryden, okay.
My old friend from before college, from high school. But we were back in my old area, and we were coming back from the Pomona Fair. We used to drive streets looking for old cool stuff. And
you were looking for just old buildings?
We didn't have a name. Yeah, old buildings. We didn't have a name.
Was it tiki stuff that you were looking for?
Everything was new.
Anything that was cool.
Yeah, old 30s stuff was cool.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the tiki stuff was really cool, but we didn't. I didn't realize this was a real style at the time.
Right.
I didn't realize that until I got Alan Hess's book, Googie.
Oh, yeah.
And he mentions it very briefly.
Yeah.
That Armin Davis started doing that. And then it like clicked. It's like that. Oh, it was a thing that I saw when I was a kid. Like that was a movement. But I'd just grown up, you know, I'd grown up around it, and I just thought it was like the most natural thing on earth to have tikis and waterfalls and fire on buildings. It just didn't seem weird.
So you didn't actually have an influence. I mean, this is why I think that you were the first guy, because you didn't have an influence as far as looking at tiki stuff or looking for tiki stuff. It came from just your interest of like thinking this was cool.
It had always been in my environment and I didn't question it. But then I went to art school, and then you start to question things, you know, in college. And we were coming back from Pomona Fair, as I was saying. We were on Las Tunas over there where it comes out where Bajuca is.
Yeah.
And Mark said, "What's that?" And I said, "It's the Bajuca." Because I'd always, you know, I'd ride my bike by there.
You'd always known it.
And he saw it for the first time. And then it like, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. This is crazy. Because then, you know, you would make that right going up north on Rosemead. And it's like one building after the other of tiki stuff.
Right.
And I was thinking, what the hell was this? This doesn't make any kind of sense to have tikis in California. And then, you know, we figured that part out, that it was a thing. And then we just started collecting bits of stuff at swap meets and places.
Right. And then when you were making those drives too, you were also hitting the thrift stores.
Yes.
And looking for old stuff.
Yes.
What about some of these places that are gone? What are some of the places that you used to see?
I used to see a lot of stuff. I mean, I got to step back one more small step.
Yeah.
We were going, my brother and I, we would go to the Pomona Auto Swap Meet.
Yeah. The Fairplex. Yeah. That's the big one that they have every 5 or 6 weeks.
Right.
Right.
And so we're walking through there. They're in the cars, whatever. I was hanging around. And we came on this old guy who was selling bikes.
Oh, like, okay.
Tricked out bikes.
Okay.
And old German guy. And I think... And he was selling this big wine box, two wine boxes full of old matchbooks that had been shucked. That means there was nothing inside
right,
of them.
Right.
And I was kind of into matchbooks at the time. This would have been mid-80s again. And I really wanted them, but they were like $30. And I just didn't have that kind of money then. And so my brother said, "I'll get them for you." And he bought them. And I took them home and I started going through them. And it was all my old neighborhoods, all this stuff in San Diego. And then in San Diego, for instance, I started seeing there was this place, Shelter Island, that had lots of tiki places. I'd never heard of it. But all the matchbooks were from there.
Yeah.
And so...
You know, when I went to Shelter Island for the first time, it was a lot less... Well, it's not really as modernized as it could be, I suppose.
I agree.
But on the far end, it's a lot more modern than it is as you enter it.
Yes.
As you enter the peninsula. And God, I just remember being so amazed at all the A-frames.
Yeah.
And they were sweeping A-frames.
Yes.
You know, that...
Very elaborate.
Yeah, very elaborate. And I just thought, wow, this is so cool. And what's a shame is that you have places like the Kona Kai, which is at the end of the peninsula, which looks all Mediterranean. You know, they kept the name, but...
Well, actually, they lost the name for a while, and now they took it back.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And I guess what I'm getting at is that, God, it's such a bummer to see those things change, you know?
You wish they would embrace it like Palm Springs embraced their whole modern history.
Right,
you know, because you see... I don't know if you went to Palm Springs before. We used to go 25 years ago, and it was just it was not nice.
I know. They were in that weird stage of the mid-century modern stuff was starting to look dated.
It wasn't appreciated.
Yeah. So a lot of people were looking at it as just an old building or an old eyesore that they just wanted to remodel, you know?
I agree.
Yeah. And then it's only in the past maybe two decades that they've really kind of started to embrace that whole mid-century aesthetic and bring it back to...
But you see people come from all over the world to experience that there now.
Yeah.
Whereas even 10 years ago, it was kind of... I mean, it was getting big then, but... So that's what you have in San Diego. It was the same thing. When they developed Shelter Island and Mission Bay, it was 100 square miles.
Yeah.
60... Well, Shelter Island was there before 60... 59, I believe, the master plan was to develop 100 square miles. Because that was like where they would dump sewage.
Oh, wow.
Mission Bay. It was just a swamp.
Oh, that's interesting.
So the Army Corps of Engineers came and they planned this whole master thing. And it was all done in the Polynesian style.
So going back to what you saw that was out there that doesn't exist anymore, you know, like... The stuff that I've seen in the past 20 years that we've lost is like a bummer to me. Well, you talked about Bahuka.
Yes.
That's one. And having enjoyed that place for decades.
Yes.
And taking my kids there.
Yes, yes.
And then me taking too. It for granted.
Yes.
Right? And then all of a sudden one day you hear that it's going to be shut down.
Well, I know. I mean, I always knew its time was kind of up. The owners were older.
Right.
But and I did really appreciate, you know, when we were in the area, we would stop by. But I mean, it was a miracle to me that it lasted as long as it did.
Well, okay. They stayed pretty busy though. But you mean just like with the change of taste?
I know, I think you could have made it work.
Yeah.
You know, it's just I don't know. I mean, I only met the owner lady once and I have a longer story about this, we're not going to get into it, but she just seemed to me like didn't have that in her to take it to the next generation. I don't think there was anybody there to take it, to pick up the torch.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a few like that. Like, for example, the Royal Hawaiian, who's making a nice...
It's very impressive.
Making a nice comeback with what they're doing.
Yeah.
But when the original owners sold it in 2006,
yes,
I think it was the same scenario. They just didn't have another person to carry the torch.
Whoever they sold it to, I spoke to the person. She said she was the designer and she was going to do it in a light tiki.
Yeah,
it's like when they say that, that means they have no budget. And
right,
they don't want to see tikis. They want to see whatever, white walls, or I don't know what they want to see. But that's always a real. When they say that, it's like,
So that's another one. I mean, like, they're making a nice comeback, though. But when we originally lost them, I was bummed out about that. I saw the Bahuka go down. Yep. I saw...
all the apartments on Rosemead Boulevard. Almost all of them.
Yeah. I saw Trader Vic's in Beverly Hills go down.
Yeah.
I saw... Well, I didn't get to see the Hanalei Hotel in San Diego go down because it was... By the time that I had... got to enjoy the Islands restaurant there.
Yes.
It had already been remodeled.
Yeah, that was...
But the Islands restaurant had still remained intact. And the lobby as well. I wouldn't say like all of the lobby. They still had the waterfalls and they still had tikis all about. But the Islands restaurant still had the waterways and it still had the clamshell waterfall.
Yeah, they had flipped the entry around at the first remodel or that remodel. Because
okay.
You used to come in through... through the West End. There was a big A-frame you would go through. There was a bridge you would cross. It was beautiful. I mean, the way...
So then I missed that one, too.
Yeah, John Mock designed that, and he just did a phenomenal job. But, I mean, you had the shells, all the lava rock. You'd walk along these waterfalls, those anchors. So before you even got in, your brain was already moving in this... You're hearing
in that
water.
Direction, yeah.
You're leaving this world to go to the next. And then you would go through the A-frame from the west side. There used to be a coffee shop on the bottom, as I recall. And then you would kind of catty-corner up into the islands.
Okay. So I didn't see that.
Yeah.
But I did see the restaurant when it still had the waterways. And
yeah.
It still had all the rattan and the bamboo and all and the again
they had cleaned it up. I don't know how to quite. They had changed some things. I know you saw like the bones of it. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Because I have a bunch of the lamps that they got rid of.
Yeah.
They had auctioned a bunch of stuff off.
Didn't you go dumpster diving there?
That was my brother.
Oh, that was your brother.
Yeah.
Okay. I heard a story that it was you.
I've dumpster dived with him at other places.
I heard that they, And so the assumption is that it was you that I heard this about, and they confronted you. So I guess
that
it was
my
your brother.
Yeah.
And the dumpsters were full.
They were packed.
Packed with vintage decor.
Everything.
Tikis and lamps and all this kind of stuff.
Now we got to step back another 4 or 5 years. Before they did that remodel, they did the outside remodel. So they had scraped a bunch of stuff off. There was tikis that disappeared. They got rid of the big sign that was really cool.
Right.
I tried to say that, and the guy was just a real jerk. I mean, you know, we had set up, my brother was working for a guy at the racetrack who had trucks and cranes.
Yeah.
So I tried to get the sign to save it, and we had a way to get it here and everything. But the guy, he put me in contact with the sign people, and he was just the biggest jerk. He's just like, no, it's in the contract. We were paid to destroy this thing. And I'm like yelling at him, you have a piece of history.
Right? Yeah, really?
Like, he sounded like an idiot. And so, yeah, that was that remodel. And then the interior remodel was a few years later. But
what are some of the other spots that you guys went dumpster diving at?
I went alone to the Tahitian Village in Downey. I got in there when they remodeled that. That would have been 2000.
Okay.
I don't remember the year. Probably 2000. My truck was a 2001.
Okay.
Or 2000. Sorry, my truck was
Tahitian Village in Downey. I'm trying to visualize.
It was huge. It was almost a square block.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They had a coffee shop. They had a hotel. They had a liquor store. They had a barber shop. I mean, it was big.
Yeah.
You know,
did you get anything from that?
Yeah, I got a lot.
Oh, okay, good.
When the astronauts came from, I don't remember which Mercury mission it was, they built a rocket just down the road.
Okay.
And they took them there to celebrate.
Okay.
It was that's the level of place it was.
You know?
And so, I went down there. I think Otto told me he heard it was being torn down. We would stop by occasionally, my wife and I, on the way to LA to see what's going on, because it was boarded up for the longest time. And I got there and, they were tearing it to pieces. They were disassembling it and taking all the lumber to Mexico. And so then I found whoever I thought was in charge. I bought him breakfast and I told him, I want this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So the bridge was still left. There were tikis inside, but they had knocked that part of the building down, so you couldn't get in there. It was just like piles of rubble.
Right.
I'll show you. It's out back. I've got a whole bunch of that stuff. I've got some the cones they would put up on top of the flame things.
That must have been a killer, knowing that tikis were in there and you couldn't get to them.
It was, but when I showed up, another guy came wanting the tikis too.
Oh, do you know who that was?
No, I have no idea. But I thought, you know, when I introduced myself, he go, he's going to know who I am, because I was still, you know. And he had no idea who I was.
Oh, okay.
He goes, you mean like the Catholic high school, Don Bosco? Yeah, right, dude. So it's like, get out of here.
Yeah.
And he let me cut down the bridge, the stuff that was holding up the bridge. I got all that. I filled up the truck. I got Eames chairs were in there.
Oh, cool.
They were packed in this office in the back. I mean, there was hundreds of them.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
So that leads me to ask you, if you've been to a site that had so much that you could salvage, but you just didn't have the resources to take it all.
In that case, I took what I wanted. And let me get to your question next. But there was a homeless guy living in there.
Okay.
And he told me there was tikis in there.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, well, show me where they are. I said, I'll give you $20. And he was helping some guy cut some wrought iron down or something. He goes, no, I have to help him. So I'm standing around waiting, and an hour or so went by. And he goes, okay, I'll show you where it is. So he was like my guide, this jungle of just this destruction. And we went way back in the building, but it was just, everything was just buried. So, but a place that I had gone that had more than I could carry, I couldn't afford it. It was at the tikis in Lake Elsinore.
I was going to ask you about that next, because the tikis in Lake Elsinore, for many years, you would drive by there and you could see it off the freeway and it was abandoned. And there were tikis there.
Yeah. Well, when I was going to college, I would go that way and they would light it up at night.
Oh, okay.
Totally lit up. I mean, I thought it was a miniature golf course.
Oh, really?
Well, it was huge.
Okay, you know? Okay.
And there was all these colors, and you're just thinking, what the hell is that place? And I would leave notes in their mailbox, and they would never get back to me. I got another thing I'll show you from college. When like the first promo I did for my illustration was a tiki thing.
Okay.
So I left that in their mailbox and wrote, "What is this place?" And then they called me back, and whoever these idiots were.
Yeah.
So, what do you want to know? You know? So, whatever. That was out. And because still, even at that time, I had no idea what this was.
Right.
You know, I didn't know.
Did you ever see the tikis in Monterey Park?
No, but we used to go. I must have seen it because our church was just on the other side of it.
Okay.
It was in Monterey Park. And I must have passed it.
Did you ever see Kelbo's while it was open?
Yes, yes, yes. We went to Kelbo's a lot.
Did you ever get to... Now, when they switched over to Fantasy Island,
yeah,
I ended up with assuming
a bunch of that stuff.
Okay, so did you go dumpster diving?
No,
there,
I didn't. I was ready to go, and who I can't remember. John English had a friend that had bags full of this stuff and had to get rid of it.
Okay,
and it just saved me the trip.
Oh wow!
I ended up with a whole bunch of the floats.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
because when it changed over to Fantasy Island. I always wondered what happened to some of the decor there. Like it got all removed.
Yeah, it was all thrown out in the garbage. Yeah, the Wan Q used to still be out there at that time.
Oh, the Wan Q was still open.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
I've been in there. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I went to across the street from.
And the Wan Q turned into Sugar Shack.
Didn't know that.
So that was a while ago.
Yeah, I remember the original sign. I mean, it said Wan Q.
Yeah.
Across the street from Sam's, which is now Don's, there used to be a place called Noel's.
I didn't know that. Is that where Taco Surf is now?
Whatever's it. There's still tiki's in the front, right?
Yeah, well, there was. I haven't looked lately, but there was a big one in the parking lot.
There was
and
two.
It had kind of a little menacing face on it, but that was years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's still there. I didn't pay attention.
Yeah, that would have been one of the first places.
Okay, so that's Taco Surf today.
Yeah. But it was Noel's then, and it was a tiki place. I mean, it was full on, just packed with stuff. And the guy told me they're gonna demo it, and I got really excited. And,
yeah.
Whatever I was trying to save it. I really wanted to save it. I was very at the front of that then. By then, I knew Sven though, and Jeff.
So when you were doing all this stuff, were you bumping into anybody else other than that one guy that was trying to save anything?
No, everybody I knew was up in L.A. And we were down here
right.
in San Diego, Riverside, San Bernardino. We were the only people that I knew.
Right.
And for instance, my brother and I, one time, we decided we were going to go east of here looking for thrift stuff.
Yeah.
And went out, drove by the Salton Sea and that whole wreck of a place. You know, it was beautiful, but I mean, it was all just abandoned stuff from the mid-century. We're flying down the road there, and all of a sudden, there's a huge sign that says Tiki Bar. It's like, locked it up, went up it was in Desert Shores, we went up that road, and it's creepy as hell, you know.
Okay.
Nobody there, all these trailers, get up there, the tiki's got bullet holes in it, it's got a big, like a padlocked steel gate, and it was a tiki place, tiki bar, and no one was there. Next time he went, it was all gone.
Wow.
And then the tiki ended up staying, and like an idiot for many years, I went back there not putting it together that they had boxed the tiki inside of this box.
Uh-huh.
So it had been there the whole time. I thought they just took it out. And then as soon as Sven announced it, somebody went down there, I assume on Tiki Central.
Oh,
read it,
man.
And they stole
and
it.
They stole it. I read that story. I remember reading that story on Tiki Central.
It was gone literally the next week.
Right, right.
But whoever that carver was, he had more carvings around there.
Yeah. And so we don't know who that carver was.
Uh-uh.
It was just a local guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was even one here in Escondido. I never met him. I knew where he lived.
What were some of the spots out here that you saw before they were taken out? Because San Diego was devoid of tiki for a long time until recently. Before, for the past couple decades, there was really only the Valley High that was...
And the islands. I mean, islands never really kind of went away.
Well, yeah.
You know.
But I mean, evolved. Like, that, yeah, you're right. And Humphreys also. Humphreys had some tikis in there.
Yeah. Everything in San Diego, even back in the day, was kind of toned down. It was more of a... I know Sven and I have disagreed on this, my analysis here, but it was more Polynesian modern. It wasn't tiki modern.
Okay.
Per se.
Okay.
And there was only a few tikis in any of these places.
Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, only recently have we started to see things pop up. Mr. Tiki was the first probably modern tiki bar, which is what you carve. How many tikis did you carve for that?
Oh, heavens, I don't know. I am well over 20, 30. I mean, but they were big. Many of them were huge carvings.
Yeah. And after that went away, we waited a few years before we got, now we have False Idol.
Yep.
Which, again, you did work on that.
Yeah, all the work, yeah.
And
carving.
And I think who else do we have? Grass Skirt,
yes. And there's a few other places in town that call themselves tiki bars, but there's nothing tiki in there. There may be a tiki, but they serve the drinks.
Right.
And they call them tiki drinks, and now because you're serving tiki drinks, it must be a tiki bar. And that's not the case.
Yeah. Well, speaking of tiki bars, I want to talk about your Kapu Tiki Room.
Sure.
Because, you know, I started doing this tiki thing. I was first aware of it in the 80s, but I didn't know what it was. I mean, it was, and I've told this story before, it was with my grandparents. They had renewed their wedding vows at their 50th wedding anniversary. They had a whole ceremony and everything, and the reception was at Don the Beachcomber in Marina Del Rey. So that was what opened my eyes to what tiki was. I didn't know it was a thing, but it was where I started to gain interest for that. And it wasn't until really the 90s. It was probably the early to mid 90s, somewhere maybe around 94 to 95, where I really started to take it more seriously. And I started actively collecting things.
Uh-huh.
And even back then, I knew about this mythological place called the Kapu Tiki Room.
Yeah.
And that's your home bar. From my assumption, whatever the right word is for that, being, in my mind, the first tiki urban archaeologist, that was probably the first home tiki bar.
It was the first home one. People in the old days had their own bar, but this was different. It was an homage to a real tiki place, you know.
Okay.
It was with that.
So I should say the first revivalist home tiki bar.
It's what everybody sort of bases their home bar on. Because in the old days, you wouldn't necessarily have a display mugs. Like
right.
We do, but they wouldn't have done that.
So when you built this, what was your purpose for building it? Was it to house a collection?
It was manyfold. It was more than one. Originally, I built it because I used to go to Tiki Tea. I used to live around the corner from it in L.A. before I moved back here.
All right.
And I wanted something like that corner they got.
Yeah.
I wanted something like that. And then I started thinking, well, why don't I build a room, like a installation for a piece of art? Like build a bar that you could take and put somewhere, rebuild it somewhere. And then I had all these mugs. I had to do something with them. And so then it started coming to me, well, why don't you show the mugs off, the history of this thing, you know? Then so it became like a museum to it. It became an homage. It was multi-layered what I did. But I mean, it was the template that everybody takes now. It was the template I used when I did Taboo Cove.
I was going to say, the front of the bar looks like Taboo Cove.
Yeah.
And
that's intentional. And so, but back in 90, nobody did this. I mean, it wasn't, I dare say, it probably wouldn't be for another 10 years. So people started doing more elaborate rooms.
Oh, sure.
And I'd have people come in and they would start laughing, and they would be laughing.
Oh, they would laugh.
Yeah. They would be laughing the entire time. It was just so absurd to them. That
really?
Really.
Wow.
I kid you not.
Wow. You know, to me, it was, and you've used the word mythological before, because I'd only seen it in pictures for years. And I never thought that I'd ever be able to stand it. And one day, what, like 10 years later, there I am standing in the middle of the room, and I'm thinking, wow, so this place is real. And not only was it real, but everything in the room has a pedigree. Every lamp.
Just about.
Every piece of decor. Yeah. And then all the mugs, they're all vintage.
Yeah, hand collected. The hard way.
Yes.
Artisanally collected. Yeah. Well, then as the concept evolved, I wanted it to become like this destination that people would know what this was.
Right.
But you couldn't know what it was because you'd never see it. I mean, the word got out there, you know, Jeff put it on the grog log in the back, and that was people's first view of what a bar was supposed to look like, which is why he put it on there. We couldn't find a good picture of a real tiki bar. But yeah, we have customers now that said they would call the Yellow Pages or whatever, the operator, and ask, where's the Kapu Tiki Room in Escondido?
That's pretty cool.
Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah.
And it's like, they had no idea what they're asking them.
Yeah,
but
that's
funny.
But that
was intentional. You know, that's why I did, the reason I started the mugs then is I wanted a mug for my bar. Because any bar that had a mug was a real bar.
And I think the name of that mug was Chongo, right? Mm-hmm. It was the Moai with the big mouth, with the big lips?
No, not Chongo. That's just the Kapu Tiki, I call him.
Okay.
It's not a Moai. Actually, it's based on a real Hawaiian style.
Oh, okay.
I mean,
so,
it looks like a Moai, yes.
I'm thinking of something else, maybe?
You got the right mug. Wrong name.
Okay.
It does have big lips, and it's based on a Hawaiian thing. It kind of vaguely looks Easter Island on the top, but it's got a figure eight mouth.
Yeah. That's pretty cool, because, you know, that whole mythological status thing to me, it was... I mean, we were just in there earlier, and I still hold such reverence to that room, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is special in this movement. If you really appreciate what it is a very special place. It's like, you know, it's like a touchstone. That's where everything that we have now, it started there.
Yeah.
It's something to be able to recognize that in any kind of movement, you know? And, I don't know. There's been lots of places I've gone throughout my life. You know, it's like you realize you're standing in this special spot, and it's like you're the only one that gets this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, then speaking of the influence of Kapu Tiki Room was to Tabu Cove.
Yes.
That was the, I believe, the first revivalist modern tiki bars.
It was the first real,
the
what
first
you would
real
call
one, yeah.
a real tiki bar. There are other bars that came before it that had a tiki or tikis in it. But that's not a tiki bar again. I mean, these were places they were trying to get frat bros in there, and they had pool tables. They just happened to have a tiki, you know? The decor wasn't that elaborate. They didn't have swizzle sticks. They didn't have a drink menu.
It was the first place that tried to recreate the tiki aesthetic of the mid-century.
But just like my bar, it was an homage to the real thing. But we're also looking forward as well. So it was a museum to the original movement, but it was very current. It was very now.
Right. You know, when that was first opened, a lot of us Southern Californians, since we're not that far from Las Vegas, we're real excited about it. And I used to drive out there probably twice a month. Just to hang out in that bar. And I live 250 miles away from
it. I've heard that from many people in Los Angeles.
And, you know, I remember seeing a ton of vintage mugs on those walls. Those came from your collection, right? Your personal collection. What was a bummer was that over the time that they were open, they started disappearing, those mugs.
Yes, people would steal them. I've heard all about that.
Yeah, it was probably staff, I would be guessing, because it was behind the counter.
Probably. I don't know. We really kind of lost contact after the first year or so.
Yeah, it was so exciting to have that thing when it was first open. I mean, you guys had vintage menus and frames.
Yes.
And you had all the tikis along the front of the bar, which looked just like the Kapu Tiki Room.
Right.
And
album covers and frames.
And album covers and frames. And then you had tall support pole tikis.
Yes.
And
floats.
And
lights,
floats and the whole thing.
Everything, yeah.
Yeah, it was almost like stepping back in time, because the only way to see something like that before Tabu Cove was to go back to the 60s, right?
Yeah.
Or even 70s if you were lucky enough to still see something that wasn't – that hadn't aged.
That hadn't been compromised.
Yeah, it hadn't been compromised is a better word.
Yeah. Yeah, even the Trader Vic's in Beverly Hills, we had been going there. But by then, in the late 80s, mid-80s, it was already – they had taken a lot out.
So how did that job come about? How did Tabu Cove come to life?
This guy Mark Campbell got a hold of me. He had just gotten a hold of the Book of Tiki, was totally knocked out by the
– by the imagery.
What he saw.
Yeah.
He saw my name in there, saw that we had a website. He got a hold of me, and he was a designer for this group in New York that built restaurants. I don't know if you know how it works in Vegas, or not just Vegas, just everywhere. The restaurant you see, it's not like a mom and pop thing. It's run by a group.
Okay.
So that group had, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 restaurant bars inside the Venetian, and they had one place in all the casinos. They had something in all the casinos. So they had built a functioning bar restaurant in this space at the Venetian, and it was supposed to be a Southwestern thing.
Okay.
And I showed you pictures of that earlier with all that orange.
Right.
And they had paid this design firm to do it and build it, Morphus, up in Los Angeles. And before they were going to open it, they realized they had, the Southwestern thing was already over. And they were sitting on the turkey.
Oh, yeah.
And so they had worked with Mark before in their other properties. And they brought him in to do something now, current. So his side was the Venus part, that where the shag mural went into
right.
another area. Mine was the bar. And he was going for like this Rat Pack kind of thing.
Right.
And then we did the full-on real tiki bar. And
right.
That took, it was over a year, well over a year we worked on it. And then we had to convince management
yeah.
that we're running the Venetian, that a tiki bar was a cool thing, not something. Because they were from originally, I think, from Philadelphia.
Okay.
Where Kona Kai was.
Yeah, yeah.
And they remembered that, but they would go were going in there when it was already on its way out.
Right.
And they realized, they thought they didn't want like a homeless shelter in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we really had to push to sell them that this was going to be something, you know, at the level of the Venetian then. I mean, it was the biggest first-class hotel in the world.
Yeah. It was certainly a model of excess at the time.
Yes. It reflects the, yeah, it's, yeah.
Yeah. And when Taboo Cove closed, you know, obviously it's devastating to us tiki people when something like that, you know, gets built and then we end up losing it.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted to know what happened to the tikis.
Yes.
And then I had heard all these different stories that they were all stockpiled in the kitchen. And yeah. apparently...
I heard all those stories too.
Yeah. Apparently someone took a picture. I never saw the picture. And then I also heard stories that all the employees pilfered the tikis.
No.
Yeah. I heard that too. Then... What, like a decade or more later, 15 years later?
I knew
later?
What happened to them. I mean, I didn't know exactly what happened to them, but I knew they were not going to throw this. Somebody on Tiki Central wrote this long yarn about how they saw them at the dump. They dumped them in the dumpster.
Like,
come on, man. They paid so much money for this stuff. They're not going to dump it.
Well, yeah, I that's what I would think, but you know.
And they didn't. They sold it. They had warehouses all over Vegas, and they had like an auction thing, and who was Was it Art Snyder went?
Yeah, okay. So
he had a place downstairs.
That's what I was going to say. And then 15 years later, after about 15 years yeah. after it closed, they start popping up again yeah. at Don the Beachcomber in Huntington Beach.
Well, and a lot haven't popped up. I don't know where they went.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to ask you next, is if you knew where some
no
of the other
idea.
Ones ended
Nobody's
up.
Ever...
What about when Mr. Tiki closed down?
I know where all those ended up going.
Well, I know that a lot of them... I don't know if all of them, but I know all that a lot of them ended up at Bamboo to You because I stumbled upon
yes,
those
yes.
maybe 2 years ago.
Yes.
And my favorite one out of that whole bunch was that Maori that you had at the
yeah.
at the entrance, right?
Right
it
right.
was the most elaborately carved one.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, I want to get that Maori. And it was a little bit out of my price range, so I ended up not getting it. And I know that that whole set, with the exception of the big Moai that they had put the nose ring through, right?
I don't know what happened to that.
So there was a big Moai that was behind the bar that it didn't open with a nose ring through it. They put a nose ring on it. Maybe.
No, there was a designer I worked with, and she had put the more colorful touches. She
yeah.
did a great job with it. It's just she did things I would never have done it, but whatever.
I just remember that nose ring not being there yeah. when it first opened. When I
oh,
first,
I don't know when
I first walked
first,
in. And then it came in a few months later. I walked back in there, and then it had a nose ring. But with the exception of that big Moai, I know who got the whole set.
Yes.
And it went to the East Coast.
Yeah, all but one piece. The wooden piece that was based on the Contiki.
The Contiki. Which is also the same logo being shared by the Tiki T.
Yeah.
Yeah, because in the early days, a lot of those... bar restaurants would
borrow
from each other.
Quite literally. A lot of things don't change much either.
What are some of the other projects that you've worked on that maybe our listeners wouldn't be familiar with? I know
heavens,
some of them.
We better grab the book.
Yeah, I know. I know that some of the recent work that you did was False Idol.
And I was very proud of all that work. We were on the project for 14 months, and it was 5 months of carving. It's over 1,000 square feet. It's the most elaborate room in the country. I mean, I don't... It really is over the top.
And with the opening of False Idol,
uh-huh.
I noticed a change in your style.
It had come... to four. I had been working in this style for a while, but I finally kind of figured it all out.
Yeah, and it's really cool, and it's still got that that Bosco look and feel to it.
Yeah.
But it also looks new and fresh.
Yes.
And at the same time, with an homage and a nod to the vintage influences.
To everything I'm influenced by, yeah.
So, and speaking of vintage influences, when you first started carving, you know, a lot of people have compared your work to Witco.
Yes.
Is that your original influence to the tiki style that you were carving?
No, no. I had a whole other style before then. In the mid-90s, I think 97 or 8, thereabouts, I started dating my now wife, Truce. And she was in Seattle. I was down here. And I was telling Sven, I'm going to go to Seattle and go visit her for a week. And he says, oh, you know, you got to go see Bill Westenhaver. He lives north of there, and tell him I'm still interested in him. Because Sven had contacted him, but then never followed up because Book of Tiki wasn't out. So he goes, go talk to him, see if you can get any information for Book of Tiki out of him. And so, sure enough, you know, we called him. He wants to meet us. We go out to his place out in, Mount Vernon, I guess it was. Way north in Washington.
Outside of Seattle.
Yeah, maybe an hour or two. I can't remember. Okay. It was quite a drive. And there he is, this mid-century house. He has a fence in the back. It's all Witco stuff. It's like just Witco pieces lined up. His door is all Witco. Just the sweetest guy you'd ever want to meet. And we got to talking, you know. Where did you go to school? And he says, oh, I went to Art Center.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And I said, you went to Art Center? I went to Art Center.
Oh,
and
that's pretty cool.
It was great.
Yeah.
And he went on the GI Bill, and I went 50 years later.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, it was great.
Yeah,
it was
just pretty cool.
Who would have... So anyway, he explained to me how they did everything, what they used. And he's been here several times. He would come out because they would vacation down in Leisure World. And he'd drive out here with his friend. And he'd go through the shop and say, well, you don't want to do that. But it's influenced a lot by him. But I don't want to say... How do I say... his whole thing was he would design it, and then the people executing it had no idea how to – they had no artistic aspirations.
So he wasn't carving a lot of it. He was designing it.
He had a factory.
Okay. All right.
He had two factories.
Okay.
It was
interesting.
More than 50 employees in the factory. You know, it was big. They had showrooms. I've got my catalogs. I don't know, 10, 12 showrooms all over America. I mean, they had a lot of material to supply. They would buy wood by the trainload.
So – he must have been thrilled that, you know, because his work just almost got forgotten. He must have been thrilled that you were up there asking him all these questions about how he did stuff, right?
Yeah, he was thrilled. I don't know. I think initially he didn't know what to make of me because he didn't take that serious like he took art seriously. He did his own kind of art, much like I do, his own paintings and stuff. The production stuff, he knew it wasn't art per se, like...
He just looked at it as more that was his business side, and then his artistic side
correct.
Or creative side was something that he did differently.
Side.
Yeah.
But ironically, it flipped, and the thing that they did for the business became this thing that everybody knows now, or many people know now. It's Witco, but the way he did it, it's not art. You know what I mean? It's an assembly line, because you would have one guy that just would cut out the profile, another guy would do the depth. Another person would hit with a chainsaw. It was just step by step.
Right.
Nobody finished.
Another guy would torch it. Another guy would wax it.
Another person would put the whatever on the Osnaburg.
Right.
On and on and on.
Okay.
So, yeah. So we were in there. You know, we were talking to him. That's when I found that he told me the story about how he did a whole... it was this place in upstate New York. It was a bordello's. Whorehouses.
Okay. Right.
And they were all the rooms were different Witco themes. So you would take a guy in there, maybe it was a tiki room or a conquistador room or whatever.
Did he ever talk about the jungle room at Graceland?
He didn't have anything to do with it, but he didn't know. I mean, yeah, he knew that it was in there.
And they basically just purchased the stuff.
Yeah, there was some place in Memphis where, I've heard the story a couple of different ways, that Elvis had found it all, bought it, and then to freak his father out. You know, he said he went in there and bought everything in half an hour. Because that's the story they tell you when you go to Graceland.
Yeah, I haven't been fortunate enough yet to get to go to Graceland. Because it is on my bucket list, but I just haven't got to do it. Yeah. Well, that's pretty cool.
But
so you would say that it's... I mean, it's vaguely influenced then.
No, it's very influenced. How do I say it? In his case, there... I don't want this to come out wrong. He was the guy. He was the captain of the ship. He would design the thing and other people would make it. In my case, I'm designing it and
making it. And making it.
So, like, my Witco world, it actually looks like a world.
Right.
His world was, you know.
Right. So, that's interesting because if he's designing it and someone else is making it, as an artist, you would probably think, like, well, that's not coming out the way that I want it to come out.
He thought of that, and he would create a design that could be executed like that. He would simplify it so you couldn't screw it up.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because he's like he said, if you give it to it was like McDonald's. There's only one way to do it. That's,
right.
You know. And he said if you gave it to somebody that had a creative aspiration, they would immediately try to do it a little better each time. And that's not what he wanted. He just wanted to pound these things out.
Right, right.
And they did. I mean, they were hugely successful.
Yeah, and they're still very much sought after. I mean, like now their value has just seemed to skyrocket.
Yeah, for no reason, but yeah. he told me they used the cheapest material they could get their hands on.
You're right.
So
right.
It's not like it has any kind of archival quality to it.
Well, they used swamp cedar.
Yes,
and is did. It is That's that correct. Just because it was in abundance for
it
him?
Was nobody else could use it for anything, he said.
Oh,
it was
okay.
Like a second or third growth. Because the original cedar, they had cut it down.
Okay.
And the roots would get left in the swamp, and then this stuff would come up, and you couldn't use it structurally. It was just useless to people.
Okay.
And you could get it cheap. And so he would like send out an order. They want X amount of whatever, 12 by 12 by 6 feet. And they would just come in, you know, a train.
And all this time, I thought they were using swamp cedar because of the characteristic of the wood.
It has an extraordinary characteristic because, you know, it would grow faster. And so the grain gets really wild because even when I pick my redwood, I go for second growth.
Now, I have a redwood tiki of yours.
Uh-huh.
And it looks very much like the grain or texture of swamp cedar.
Yeah. And that's what I'm going for.
Right.
Because there are grains that grow faster or wetter or I don't know how you could quite... It's not as tight.
Yes. Yes.
And that's what I'm looking
and that
for.
Is part of the characteristic of that tiki.
Correct.
Which is I actually embrace that.
Yes.
Because as it's split over the years, it's pretty dry now. So I've had it for probably 15 or 16 years. And when I first got it, it split maybe two or three times.
Uh-huh.
And... which kind of bugged me at first. But now I embrace that characteristic of that tiki.
Yes. It's just natural in wood. And in Witco, when you would buy it, they had like this little warranty thing. And they're telling you it's perfectly natural for it to check. And when it does, just rub shoe polish in there.
Right, right. So, yeah. Yeah. I think what I did was because the outside of the log was burned. And when it split open, the inside of the log... was fresh looking.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I think what I did was took a torch to it to kind of match it all up.
Sure.
You know? And it matched up nicely.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very forgiving.
Okay.
And it's great for like when we do it for commercial stuff, if you're doing molding or something. I tell anybody we send it, if you do anything to it, if you wreck it in any way, we can fix it.
Oh, really?
So don't freak out. Because people, I've had customers and they start treating it like a piece of furniture. And it's like, no. This is very quick, easy to install. You can't screw it up.
Yeah.
This episode is sponsored in part by Tiki Diablo, artist, carver, builder, and mug maker, with an extensive client list including Mission Tiki Drive-In, Tonga Hut Palm Springs, Tiki Co., Hennessy's Tavern, Walt Disney Imagineering, Lowe's, and Home Depot, plus art installations at Latitude 29 and Undertow. For custom art, tikis, mugs, or build-outs, find him on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at Tiki Diablo, or on his website coming soon, tikidiablo.com. This episode is also sponsored in part by Steadfast Pomade. Steadfast Pomade is a strong-holding, medium-bodied, water-based styling product for men and women, which leaves your hair looking slick, neat, and shiny with a clean, fresh scent. Its unique formula allows you to easily restyle your hair throughout the day and washes out with ease. Steadfast Pomade is American-made and veteran-owned. Available in original and anchor hold, get yours today at steadfastpomade.com. Tame the waves and keep it steadfast.
I want to talk about your tiki mugs.
Yes.
And the mugs that you make.
Yes.
Again, like the first person to build a revivalist home bar, and in my mind, the first person to start carving tikis in the vintage style in modern times.
Yes.
I believe you were probably also the first mug maker.
No, that by that, there's no question. I mean, it wouldn't be till the 2000s.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure.
I was the only one for a long time.
For a long time. And so when you first started making tiki mugs, it's obvious that you were inspired by the vintage mugs.
Yeah.
Were you trying to recreate some of those in your style, or were you trying to do something totally different?
Again, it was a nod to before. If you look at the first one I did, that bug eye thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like any tiki I've ever seen.
Yeah.
But I was going for this alien primitive look, and as crude as it was, I did pull it off like that. So I was going for
this. It's funny that you say that, because that's exactly how it looks.
Yeah.
That's a great description for it. Alien primitive.
Yeah, and that's what I was trying.
You know, in the early days, you didn't have people that were mass producing tiki mugs. I mean, like, you were the first one to start making tiki mugs. So how were you... Did you learn how to do ceramics when you were at Art Center?
No, they frowned on anything like that there. It was really a commercial place.
So how are you figuring all this out with your the techniques? And there was no YouTube back then.
No YouTube, no.
So there was no looking it up online.
No, you're absolutely right. So how did I figure it out? I was just telling this story to my guy in the shop. We're pouring a bunch of new ceramics right now, and he's sitting there belly aching. It's like, what are you? I'm telling him, pay attention to what we're doing. And he does not interest. And I said, listen, you never know when some knowledge is going to help you. And so what happened to me in college, first term.
I want to interrupt you real quick in saying that kind of bugs me, because if anybody could have ceramic mug lessons from Bosco, you know, I think that no one in the tiki world would take that for granted. I think that we would all appreciate that.
I, much like Mr. Weston, he does want to be an artist, but he thinks the stuff we're doing is not really art.
Okay.
He's good at it.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have any aspirations to do it. I think if it was somebody that really wanted to learn.
I feel like going out there and saying, buddy,
you'd get nothing done.
Yeah.
And this way, he knows what his job is, I know what mine is, and we work. If it's somebody out there like looking over your shoulder trying to figure out, it's I couldn't run a business.
Right. Okay, so I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, it's okay. So what I was trying to tell him was, in college, they made us take a mold-making class first term, and it was one of my favorite classes. I got an A+ in it. But at the time, I thought, what the hell are they teaching me this for? It's got nothing to do with painting. It's got nothing to do with anything I'm going to do.
Right.
But whatever, it got stuck in my head. And as I went through college, I went from 2D to 3D doing dimensional art. And but still, the mold-making class stuck in my head. And I don't know, it was right about when I met Sven. I'd been wanting to do a mug for my bar forever. It was just like kind of like this seed that was bouncing around.
Yeah, you were the first guy who was thinking about all this. You're the first guy who had the modern home tiki bar. Right? When I say modern, I mean modern times. For this generation, right? Or
this movement.
That's a better word. And then you're the first guy who had the logo for something like that. You're the first guy who's doing tiki mugs and then doing them for a home bar.
Yes. Because I knew if you had all those things, you would have a real tiki bar, an old school tiki bar.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
You know... Yeah, not to get too ahead of myself. When I met these guys, everybody had their discipline, you know?
So sure.
Sven was into the research and the history. Jeff was all about the drinks. And I was all about the art.
Yeah.
And that was just, it fell in, that was my purview, or however you would say it. This was what I did.
What was it like developing some of those early mugs?
Painful.
Yeah.
Very painful. I didn't know anything about ceramics. And so... down in town here, there used to be several ceramic places, you know, because the hobbyist places used to be big in the 60s and 70s. But by the time, I think there was only two in town, and then now there's only still one. And she must be, Mrs. Connolly must be in her 90s now.
Okay.
Late 90s. And she had kilns in the back, and I said, if I pour the green, where I didn't even know the names of these things, can you fire it? She said, oh, yeah. So... I'd pour it here. She sold the slip, pour it in the mold, come out. And at the time, you know, I had no money. Every one of those mugs, I knew exactly what they cost. I mean, it was you can't
to the penny, right? But it's like what it costs to buy the slip, what it costs to fire, and what it costs. Yeah. So were you bugging her about how do I do this and how do I do that?
I should have bugged her more, but I didn't. And so she would tell, I would take it to her, greenware, great. Bring it back with a glaze on it, great. And of course, like an idiot, I put too much glaze on it. You're supposed to, like, at the bottom here, you only put one coat.
Okay.
And it's called stepping up.
Okay.
And then after that, you don't put glaze. And I didn't know. And I just, like, slop it on.
Yeah.
So, of course, they melt, fuse themselves to the bottom of her kiln.
Oh, wow.
And she comes out all irate. She goes, did you step up your glaze? And I go, what? I didn't know anything.
I like to think that a 90-year-old lady was...
Well, then she's in her 70s.
Okay, well, a 70-year-old lady helped with the revivalist tiki mug movement.
She had absolutely no interest in it. To her, it's...
was just another piece of ceramic to her,
what
right?
She liked, she does these beautiful like porcelain dolls and paintings of her dog.
Okay.
She's Boston Terriers. Yeah. And she like does these Fabergé eggs. That to her is like art.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you'd bring in your crazy looking stuff and they're all, oh, that's interesting.
That's funny is like when you talk about these hobbyist ceramic shops, I remember when I was a kid being able to go into a shop that had a bunch of greenware on the shelves.
Yeah.
And you picked it out and I could take it home. And if I remember correctly, paint or glazing it at home.
Yeah.
I don't remember if I think I'd send it back for them to fire.
They would do it both ways. I did this as a kid. They would sell you stuff in just plaster,
mm-hmm.
and then you could just paint it, and then you wouldn't have to do anything. You like put like the fruit on the wall. Kind
yeah,
of
yeah.
I mean, I guess if you were more into ceramics, you would have gone the whole way. But another funny story. When I was, again, starting out with the ceramics, I didn't know anything, and at that time they were phasing out lead glazes. So they were still out there, the cool, really nutty glazes from the 60s, but they were disappearing really fast.
Right.
And they were replacing it with stuff that was not very interesting or exciting. So I started thinking, I got to find better glazes for these things. Because there was a whole period of time, all my mugs were only black.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like Henry Ford, you can have any color
you
want.
As long as it's black, yeah.
So I did that for a while, and then that got stupid. So I went to Laguna Clay up in City of Industry. And then they had a much bigger showroom, and they were supposed to be more helpful, and there were ceramicists working there. And there was a woman there. I don't know what college she worked at there. They did ceramics nearby. And I'm like all trying to be discreet, and I come up to her and say, listen, I don't know anything about ceramics. She goes, what are you doing in here? I said, well, tell me something, you know? And so whatever, we come back maybe 2-4 months later, I come through the door and she goes, hey, there's that guy that doesn't know anything about ceramics. I was like, I just stopped, like, oh,
you're a record scratch and everybody looks over at you.
Yep. Exactly. I was just like, God, could this get any easier?
Oh, that's funny.
God. So, yeah. So then that's how it started, very slowly, because nobody was going to pay $15 for a tiki mug.
Well, who was buying the tiki mugs back then that you were making?
Hardly anybody. It was very slow. It was mail order at first, and then I got the website in 96.
You know, when I was first getting into – well, first seriously getting into tiki, like I mentioned, like in the 90s is when I really first started to get serious about it. You were like the only guy out there. It was you. There was a guy by the name – going by the name Into the Volcano.
Yes, he was a customer first, too.
Oh, he was?
I don't want to get his name wrong. He was back east, though. I know him.
Okay. From what I remembered, he was like a student or something, and he was doing small batch mugs.
Very small, yeah.
And then there was Dynasty.
Yeah.
I mean, this was pre-Tiki Farm. This was pre-anybody, you know?
Yeah, that's...
So I had a bunch of your early stuff.
Initially, it went from... It was 15 for quite a while. It seemed like quite a while. Then it bumped it up to 20. And at every stage of this, people did nothing but complain. I mean, when I would meet them, not when they would order online.
Okay.
Or whatever. And, you know, it's like, $15 for a tiki mug?
Right.
And it's like, what, man? I can find this at a thrift. Like,
right.
It was like that kind of mentality. They didn't see that there was an artist behind
it. Well, I had that mentality with the vintage stuff. to be quite honest with you, which is funny because the way that I see it now
it's
is
flipped.
Yeah. Now I see somebody who will pay $75 for a mug that has 500 copies, but they won't spend $75 on a vintage mug that you don't know if this is the last one that's available in the wild.
I still find myself referring to the old ones as real ones.
Yeah. So I guess what I was going to say was, you know, that's how my modern mug collection started, was buying stuff from you and Into the Volcano. I have some Into the Volcano stuff too.
And
what I regret is not buying more.
So did I. He went through some issues. We spoke later and he always said he was going to start doing them again.
And he never did. And I regret buying more of your stuff too, because some of that early stuff, I remember holding off on it because I, after putting two or three together, it was going to be more than I wanted to spend.
Yeah.
And I think, I'll go get this next time.
Yeah.
And you would discontinue stuff all the time.
Well, you know, the mold only lasted so long, 40, 50, whatever castings.
Yeah, but it seemed like back then those mugs were going out
to you, it seemed that way. To me, it seemed like they were here like dinosaurs.
Oh, really?
Was a long
period. Yeah, you're probably sick of seeing them. Yeah. Well, I know a lot of the early stuff is sought after because every once in a while something will pop up on the secondhand market, and I know that I've clamored for some of it.
Oh, no, we have some very, very dedicated fans, friends, collectors that like my stuff, and they have more than I do. They own more of my work than we own.
Oh, yeah.
It's really impressive, and it's great to see it all together. I love it.
You know, when you make your mugs, because after having walked your property earlier, there's mugs everywhere. Yes. There's mugs all in the garden. There's mugs on kitchen tables. There's mugs on the counters. And then you have all your tikis all over the garden as well. Yes. So this applies to both making your mugs and making your tikis.
Yes.
Do you have a hard time saying goodbye to some of the stuff?
Initially I did, yes, but I got over that very quickly. You know, you just had, if you're going to do this professionally, you can't start treating everything like...
You can't get attached to it.
Yeah. Because you have, once it's gone, you have no control.
Yeah.
And,
because you've got a lot of cool stuff in the garden.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. I mean, the bigger pieces, we'll do them, they'll stay around for a while.
Okay.
I do that just for myself to get something out of my system. Most people don't need a 12 or 16 foot tiki.
I'll take one. All
right. we'll get a rope and tie it to the rope.
Right.
For the ceramics that are all over the yard, if they were broken or whatever, we would throw them in the yard. And I started doing that for two reasons. When I met Truce in Seattle, any kind of broken pottery she had, she would like put it in her garden.
Yeah.
And I thought, that really looks cool.
Yeah.
And then I started thinking, well, you're creating this archaeological thing for down the road. I mean, because I don't know where they all end up in the yard. You know, they get buried by gophers.
Get buried, right.
And so maybe we'll find it again. Maybe we don't. But it is fun when people come over that know what they're looking at, and there's like a $400, $600, $800, $300 mugs just sitting there in the dirt.
Right.
And they get all...
I tell you, man, it kind of kills me when I walk past it and I see just one like half buried, and I'm thinking, I think I'd like to unbury that, put it in the dishwasher and take it home.
It's probably broke.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it wouldn't survive.
And for the people that are listening, that maybe to give you a better perspective on what Bosco means by the mugs getting buried and disappearing, the property is not exactly small. There is a palm tree farm in the backyard and their garden.
It might look like a farm.
There's quite a few rare palm trees and other...
cycads.
Yeah, yes. Other pieces of foliage that are being grown here and overgrown, which makes that tropical vibe really punch, especially with your tikis.
And the buildings.
And when you have all of the mugs scattered about the walkways, there's paths all over the place. So it is easy for a mug to get lost or buried.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah.
We were doing tractor work here, I don't know, end of last year, and had a problem with the tractor. We called the company, the rental guy, to send out a tech, and he comes out here, and he came in through that gate, and the tractor was in the back, and my two guys were with me, and I'm running him up there, go, find out what's wrong with this tractor, and this guy's like going like this, like trying to see what the hell is this place. There's all these big carvings around him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I know it can be overwhelming if when you come over here for the first or whatever 10th time, it's just there's just stuff everywhere, you know.
I've been here several times.
Yeah.
More times than I remember, to be quite honest with you. And each time that I come, it's different. Either I see something different or you've done something different.
No, we're working on it regularly.
Yeah, yeah. You always have new pieces of art up or new carvings or whatever
it is. Or planting.
And I think the last time I was here, you had some tall wall carvings mounted to the back of the house.
It's still there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't see it this time, maybe because I was looking at the new stuff. Yeah, there's all kinds of new stuff to look at. You know, as an early revivalist, I'm curious what your thoughts are about the resurgence the way that it is today. You know, when you were the only guy dumpster diving and you were the only guy making tiki mugs and building, you know, the Kapu Tiki Room, did you ever think that it would be the way that it is?
No, not at all. Nothing. That didn't hit me until much later. It was purely an art thing that I do just to do art. I do that still. There's stuff that people do not see that I do. It's not yet for public consumption, and that's how I approached it.
You know, at the risk of sounding like a tiki elitist, as somebody that you know, for me, that's been in the genre or movement for over two decades, I feel very protective of it. And I can't imagine how you must see it because of how long you've been in it.
Well, when we first started the business, seriously started the business when Truce moved here, because she has the mind for bookkeeping and things. So I just don't, you know, I'm an artist. We went and met Mr. Westenhaver. I showed him my portfolio. And there's that cook that I have done a few times, the long, elongated Cook Islands.
Yeah.
It was one of my very first carvings. My dad helped me carve it.
That's what the head turned sideways?
It's just stretched too long for a cook. It's like 7 feet. It's in the Taboo Art of Tiki.
Okay.
It's in there. I was able to execute that thing really quickly because I knew I had a vision in my mind what I wanted. I had the reference for it, and I had my dad who could carve anything.
So
he did the carving. I would just tell him lower, higher. And the whole time we're doing, he's teaching me how to carve. But I showed that carving to Mr. Westenhaver. And it was like a five-day slow hand carving. I didn't use any electric tools at the time. And he looks at it and he goes, "How long did that take you?" I said, "5 days." He goes, "My boys could knock it out in 15 minutes. And I went, "Wow."
Yeah.
And Truce heard that, and she just would not let up.
Yeah.
It's like, do it like that, because I was just so slow then, you know.
Yeah, so she's seeing it from a business perspective, and you're seeing it from artistic perspective.
And so it was the same in the ceramics. When we started carrying the imported stuff, I did not want that crap on my website.
Right.
Because it was like this pure thing.
Right.
But it's going to bring you an income, and you can't live if you're not making money.
I did buy one.
That's all right. I have many. It's just it really took an adjustment of the concept in my head.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. And so I was doing this already in the 90s.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess you could say compromising. I don't think so. Because now it is
is a compromise.
Yeah, but I mean, you see what I'm able to do now, the projects we get, they're much more elaborate than anything 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So you get to express yourself like that, and your fan base expands, so you are able to make a living.
So it's sounding like you think it's kind of good.
There are parts of it that are really good for us. There are parts of it that drive me crazy. It's like you're yelling at the TV like an idiot.
Yeah, you know, and I think I know what you're getting at, because with the popularity of something comes the devolution of that.
Yes,
that thing.
Yes. Yeah, well, yeah, yes. That's one part of it. Yes.
Whatever it is, you know, whether you're collecting Beanie Babies or you're collecting baseball cards or you're collecting tiki mugs.
Well, it becomes diluted, you might say, and suddenly where there was only one expert 20-something years ago who was you, now there's 4,000 or more.
Right, right.
And now everybody's got an opinion, and many people have stories, and I mean, people have wrong stories.
Sure, yeah.
And it just keeps, like, I don't know, I don't even know who these people are. You see them on Facebook. They just start arguing, like, they think anything from Disneyland is a tiki thing. And it's like, it's clearly not a tiki. There's not a tiki there. Or even, like, this thing with tiki bars, you know, there's not... a tiki on it. There's not a tiki in it, but they're still calling it tiki bar.
Right.
I mean, that makes no sense. It's absurd.
Right.
But to them, they have this opinion, and their opinion is as good as your opinion.
What I tell people when they argue that, well, that's a tiki bar, and I say, well, there are no tikis on it. How can you call it a tiki bar? You know, whatever they argue back to me, I always say to them, well, would you call that a tequila bar if all they served was vodka?
Yeah.
Right?
And they get.
Yeah, they get that.
They get a surfer bar. They get a cowboy bar. They get all that. But for some reason, this thing is open to interpretation.
Right, right.
And I don't know what that is.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've said before, I'm very protective about, I was going to say traditional tiki. I don't know if that's the right term. I'm very protective about the original American mainland interpretation of tiki. Labeled Polynesian pop.
Yes.
And I hate seeing when people say it's whatever you think it is. It's whatever. Tiki's a state of mind, man. Yeah. If you want it to be tiki, it's tiki. I don't agree with that.
No, I don't agree with it either. I mean, and they don't, again, they're not getting the absurdity of the words that they're saying.
Yeah.
They're referring to this thing, a tiki, but there's no tiki there.
Yeah. You know? Tiki has been defined. It's been defined in, or I should say Polynesian pop even has been defined. It's been defined in publications through historians and urban archaeologists that did not write the rules, that basically wrote what they observed, because a lot of this existed before they were born.
Yes.
So we're not saying that this is what it is because this is what we say it is. This is what it is because this is how it was built and how it prolificated in that time.
Yeah. I mean, if you hold up somebody like Jeff Barry, Beach Bum Barry, or Sven, their approach to this is like a scholar in a college. This is not just something they do research on the internet for 40 minutes and then write an article. They devoted many years of their life. They know this thing inside and out. And quite often, many people borrow from them and they'll do a new book, but you see it's all old material. It's their material. They change the words. Or you'll get people that, I don't know where they research this stuff, and they'll write something on what was it, Don the Beachcomber the other day that he opened in 1907 or something?
Yeah, they said 1917 or something. It was the year he was born.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, if you would just read, put a little more effort into it.
Right.
You know, you could approach it from that. But again, that's because it's more popular. So before there was only, these people were historians, but they didn't have the reach. You know, there weren't that many people into it.
Right. Right.
So, it did remain pure and special. Now, many people are doing it, and it's just kind of, I don't know. I mean, there's good and there's bad, and you just have to kind of pick your battles. And and you have to also think, people that are, not everybody that's kind of into it now is going to be like this super fan tiki person. Some people are only into it for the scene, for the partying, for this or that.
They care less
about the art part of it, which I don't understand that, but that's their thing. Or going to these festivals. I mean, if it was me, I'd just be sitting there listening to some boring old guy talking about something really really hard. Like the thing I was saying about Sven, like, we will, it's not a mean fight, but it is an argument. I say it's Polynesian modern, he says it's tiki.
Right.
And we'll sit there and arm wrestle like in that Old Man in the Sea, that scene with Spencer Tracy where he's arm wrestling for 2 days and they're sweating, you know.
Right.
And, you know, that's the level we look at it at.
This episode is sponsored in part by Big Toe Art. With over 20 years in the Southern California surfing and apparel industry, Big Toe fuses tiki, surf, and custom culture imagery to create one-of-a-kind paintings, jewelry, mugs, and more. To see his amazing work or pick up a cool mug, painting, or print, find him on Facebook or Instagram at Big Toe Art or visit his website at bigtoeart.com.
Let's talk about your Art Center days. I want to go back to that. Do you have stories from when you were going to Art Center, things that were influencing your work when you were there?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I was into I got to show you my portfolio from then. I mean, I was really, the way this whole tiki thing started for me.
Were you into tiki when you were at Art Center already?
I was just discovering it then. I was just picking up like Coco Joe's and a mug here and there. I still had a place, a room at my parents' house.
Okay.
Upstairs. And I can show you the shelf that's in the shop now. I built this little shelf where I put all my cool stuff that I would pick up. It wasn't just tiki per se. But I think I had 3 or 4 tiki mugs on there. I have a picture of it somewhere. And at the time, this was really early on, I sat there and I said, wow, I wonder if I could find more, if I could find enough tiki mugs to fill that shelf up. And in no time, that was done.
Yeah, this was when? The 80s. Yeah.
Six.
So I think back to the 80s when I was hitting thrift stores.
Yeah.
I'm such an idiot because like back then... I was hitting thrift stores for clothes, looking for clothing. I was looking for vintage leather.
Yeah.
I was looking for vintage hot rod style jackets, car club jackets, that kind of stuff. And I didn't look at tiki stuff because it was off my radar at that time.
There was a lot of stuff like that, yeah.
And I cringe to think of all the thrifting. And I would do half a dozen thrift stores maybe two or three times a week. Just looking for clothes. Because clothes were like, I could get a jacket for a dollar.
Yeah.
And so I would hit maybe three or four one day, three or four another day, three or four another day. I'd do it maybe three or four days a week. And I cringe to think about how much tiki I left behind.
Yeah. I can imagine. I mean, yeah, we could do a whole podcast just thrifting. I mean, there was one place I worked right near it here in town when I came back. And I would go get lunch for the guys who were doing construction. I would go in there, but it was between the lunch place and work. Every day I would get one. Every day. Every day.
And
it was Salvation Army.
And it was here in Escondido.
You'd find this stuff everywhere.
Was it from places that were nearby or was it
from... No, it was from, it was the typical Trader Dick's and kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, some of it was really great. It you know how it falls on the scale. It's like the really rare stuff you only find it 1% of the time and then there's all the fill.
Yeah.
The Harvey's mugs and all that. But still, every time you found one, you would just get that charge.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
So, whenever I walk into a thrift store and I see a mug from across the room, if I'm lucky enough nowadays, it for whatever reason, it feels like the moment that I see it, everyone else has. And now it's a race to get to it first.
I think I'm being paranoid if I think that. But it is neat that you have the same exact feeling.
Yeah.
That you got. It's like falling in love or something. It's really.
It's treasure hunting.
It's the thrill of acquisition. Yeah.
I had a dream once where I was thrifting and I was, walking up to a shelf full of tchotchkes and buried in this particular shelf that was kind of below the halfway point, I saw a vintage mug that I had. And I know it's vintage because I know all the modern day mugs. It was vintage. It looked vintage, but it was a style that I'd never seen before.
Huh.
And so I picked it up to look at it and it had an old restaurant name on it. I don't recall what the name was, but then I thought, I should see if there's any more. So I look back at the shelf and I see another one. I say, oh, cool. So I put the first one in my cart. And I pick up the second one and I'm looking at it and again, different from the first one, but something I haven't seen before. And I thought, wow, I wonder if there's any more. And I look back at the shelf and as my vision starts to focus on the shelf, I'm realizing that the whole shelf is full of these vintage mugs.
Hey, were they?
This was a dream.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, and I got so excited, I started filling up the cart, and now my dilemma was, can I afford to buy all these mugs? Wow. Because I wasn't going to leave any of them behind. Right?
Should Freud look into this?
I know. I did get lucky one time that I walked into a Savers, and this was probably about maybe 13 or 14 years ago. And one of the things that up until recently that was still where I could still find treasures was in the record bins.
Yeah.
And, mugs were hard to find at that point. Good vintage Hawaiian shirts or anything that, vintage cocktail paraphernalia. It was hard to find that stuff, but people still weren't looking in the record bins. And I went to a Savers. And I found, I think, a total of almost 70 vintage Hapa'ali, an old Hawaiian records. There was a lot of Martin Denny in there, Arthur Lyman. What it looked like was, there's somebody passed away and the kids came and cleaned out their record collection and donated it all. But I filled up a shopping cart and I flagged down a manager and I said, hey, I want to buy all these records. And I know that, and at the time they were a dollar a piece. It's not that cheap anymore at a Goodwill to get a record.
Know.
Yeah, they've gone up to sometimes $4, $5 a record.
Good
know.
Luck.
I know. So I said, hey, there's about $70 worth of records here. And I said, you know, I really can't spend $70 on all these records. Would you take an offer of maybe $40? And he said, yeah. He's like, oh, I'll do $40 for you. So I paid $40 and I walked out with a shopping cart full of records.
Yeah.
You know, I use a lot of it as decor, and a lot of it, there's just some real great gems in there because that stuff never got transferred to any kind of digital media at all. So it all got lost, you know, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, I think eventually everything will make it onto the internet somewhere, you'd think, but I don't know. I mean, yeah, there's some stuff that records I have that are so obscure. It's like, why would somebody put any kind of time into saving this?
Sure.
Thing. It's just so weird. I still got to get back to the Art Center thing, but I had a similar thing.
I'm sorry. Okay. I have a tendency to
that's all right.
to wander.
No, it's like, you know, with the thrifting thing, it was a period of time, you know, you were kind of an adult at this time, and you knew the stuff you were putting your hands on was special. It was only going to be here for a limited amount of time.
Right.
It's just so easy to be nostalgic about it.
Yeah.
I meet people that have nothing to do with Tiki that talk about their, you know, they used to go out to wherever thrifting, and the same kind of stories, or estate sales and things. And you're not just in there looking for stuff. You're wandering in the urban environment. You're finding buildings. You're finding compelling things that are compelling to you. Signage, this, that. It's an adventure. You know, it was very exciting.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
But we were in Riverside, Truce and I, thrifting, and I found this box of Big Daddy Roth iron-on transfer.
Yeah, that was popular in the 70s.
And there was a whole box of them.
Yeah.
And each one, they put them in a bag, and they went like $1 each.
Okay.
So I go up to the girl, and I go, how much for the whole box? Thinking she's going to say like $100. And she goes, $10.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome.
We would sell them at Oasis.
Yeah.
It was that kind of thing. But to go back to Art Center, how all this started was, I don't know, third, fourth term, about halfway through, I really got into Elvis. And I did my hair just like he did back in the day. I had this lady that knew how to do that here in town. She showed me how to do it with the Brittle Cream and the whole deal.
And for our listeners that don't know, you have an Elvis-themed bathroom.
That's correct.
Yeah, which is cool, because I'm an Elvis guy too. My dad was an Elvis guy, and I got it from him. So
yeah,
that's the main reason why I grow the sideburns is an Elvis thing.
The king.
Yeah,
but I guess I had made some trouble in an art class because everything I did was Elvis art.
Okay.
And this guy, the teacher, really, he was like this fine art guy. He had a stick up his ass, so to speak.
So, do they not understand, like, pop art influences, or this is just a specific course of study?
He didn't like Elvis.
He just didn't like Elvis. Uh-huh.
And so, whatever. He let me have it in front of the class once.
Oh, wow.
And so then, and I was more out there than the many of my other peers. And we were going to the gym then, too, and this other guy.
Right.
So you know. And so I'm thinking, I'm not going to take this. That's all I would do now is Elvis. You know? And I just, like, I took the thunder out of this guy's his whole course. You know, he's like trying to show us, Fitzgeraldo? Is that the movie? The one where they try to get the steamship over the jungle mountain by Klaus Kinski's in it. Golly, I can't remember.
I don't know that.
It's really painful to watch. And you're sitting on this stool, you know, like one of those high stools, trying to watch this 2-hour movie. It's boring as hell.
Yeah.
You know? So he's being really serious. I'm undermining this guy. It gets out at the school like it does. I was causing trouble, like only doing Elvis art. So I went the next term into Jim Hyman's class.
Okay.
And he's the editor at Taschen now.
Cool. Right.
So he says to me, you can do anything you want, but you can't do Elvis art.
He said that too?
Yeah. So I said, all right. And so he goes, you have to do some kind of a party invitation. And I'm thinking, oh, what could I do? And
now, did he not like Elvis too? Or?
He just didn't want that nonsense to start in his class. I don't blame him. So I think, what am I going to do? So I do an invitation to a luau, and I did tikis in it. And this would be 86, 5, 6, thereabout. I can show you a picture of it later.
Okay.
So then I did that in that class. That was one of my first promo pieces. Years later, Mark is at a book fair thing.
But why did you pick tikis?
Because I was just getting back into it. You're asking, like, what was I into? And this was one of the things, you know.
Right, right. I'm just curious where the influence came from. I mean, was just something that you liked?
I just realized the absurdity of seeing tikis, like, kind of growing up with it as a kid. And but they were cool. And so I started trying to figure out, like, I want one. This is how the business started. This is how my carving started later. I wanted it, but you couldn't find them anywhere.
Right.
Nobody carved them.
Right.
So, but I wanted, like, I had in my mind this memory of what really cool California-style tikis looked like.
Yeah.
You know, and then when I went to Hawaii and I didn't see that, something... Well, no, I would see it in some places, but you wouldn't see it everywhere. So, it wasn't clicking what had happened here, you know?
Right.
And I didn't know that there was that whole other movement. So, anyway, years later, Mark's at this book thing... And runs into Jim Hindman.
Okay.
5 years later, let's say. Sometime in the 90s now. Early 90s. And Jim asks Mark, what are you into? And he says, we're like really into this tiki stuff. And he goes, you know, there's a guy shopping a book around. And it was Sven.
And it was Sven, yeah.
And about the same time, we've been going to Oceanic Arts since the 80s, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And we go in there and Leroy tells us there's this German guy who's going to do a book on it. And we're going, wow, I wonder if it's that guy that Jim mentioned.
Right.
So we got his phone number through Jim Hindman, who later they ended up publishing Sven's book, Tashin. And we went and met him over at his place. He just moved to where he is now in Silver Lake. And Mark brought his art. I brought my art. And it was just like, wow. It was just, he knew so much. It was just, I didn't have a name for any of these people.
When you first met him and you guys started talking tiki, that must have been refreshing because now you had somebody that could speak your language.
Yes, yes.
Because I bet when you were doing this stuff, on your own, you had no one really to share a passion with other than Mark.
And I were competitive with one another like that.
Right. But I mean, like, you know, now you're seeing, like, hey, there's this whole other guy who knows what we're talking about.
Well, he had words for the things.
Yeah, he coined terms.
Only were going by, like, your emotional response to this mug is, that's cool, or whatever you might think, you know.
Right.
You didn't know that was a Stephen Crane mug. You didn't know who he was. You didn't know that there was a Donna Beachcomber.
Oh, so he was... So when he came to you, when you came to him, he was...
He had all that laid out, that evolution of Tiki, he already had that laid out.
Right.
And so he showed it to us, and I'm thinking, he is talking so fast, I'm never going to remember anything he's saying.
It's just right.
Like, it was just... and then, you know, he had done the video for the Cramps, and they had a Tiki collection, and I was really into the Cramps then. It's just like, wow, you know, it's like...
Yeah.
You could just see that all these people that you were into and you all had the like-mindedness that was the...
Did it feel like a movement was about to get started?
No.
Okay, it just felt like a couple hobbyists.
It was very informal. It was very... there was never more than 10 people. Okay. Some would have these in symposiums we get invited to. There would be more people if there was a party. But those right. people weren't really into it like we were into it. To us, it was like a religion. It was very, you know, it had to stay pure. It had to...
Otto was living in L.A. at the time still,
Venice,
right?
Yeah.
In Venice. And how did he come into the picture with you guys?
I was at one of Sven's symposiums. I met him at Dale Sizer's place in Hollywood. Dale had a pretty, really big tiki collection. And then that's where I met Jeff once previously, but that's where Jeff made his Trader Vic's Grog.
Okay.
And up until that time, I thought I was like this cocktail aficionado.
Right,
but I was
right.
an idiot. I didn't know anything. But he made this drink, and I tasted it, and it was just like the top of my head just came off. It's like, what is this?
Do you remember what drink it was?
Yeah, the Trader Vic's Grog.
Okay, Trader Vic's Grog.
The lemon.
Yeah.
The passion fruit, the dark rum, the mint, all of it. It's just like, what? You know, and I'm like, what is this? What is this? I kept following him in the room, asking him, what is this? And he said, I've got this recipe book. I'll send you a copy. And he sent me in a manila envelope a whole bunch of pages of what would be the first grog log.
Yeah, that was going to be the grog log, yeah.
And so I said, I'll do a cover for you.
Yeah.
And so Otto did the inside, the graphics, Jeff did all the recipes, and I did the front cover. And then we went and shot it at Scott Lindgren's place.
And I remember the early issues of Tiki News. I have some copies that where you did the artwork on the cover.
Yeah, that was later.
Okay.
That was the first featured artist in the first Tiki News. I think Shag was second or third or something like that.
I have some early Shag art as well.
Uh-huh.
Because he was in a band with the brother of one of my good friends. And this guy is, you know, the friend of mine is not a Tiki guy. And almost 20 years ago when he had learned that I was into Tiki, he said, oh, you know what? My brother and Shag grew up together. And I've got some old artwork of his that's just sitting in my drawer that my brother gave me if you want it. And so he gave me this old drawing of the Swamp Zombies. It was some T-shirt art that Shag had done for the band that they were in. They were in a band called the Swamp Zombies. And it was pre-Shag the way that you know him today.
Yeah.
It was kind of like a monster style, I would say, for lack of a better term. Maybe that's because of the theme of the art, because it's Swamp Zombies. But it's not the very streamlined mid-century advertising style that he's known for.
Yeah.
It was much different. And so it's a very, you know, cherished piece. I don't know if cherished is the right word, but it's certainly something that most people are not familiar with that I like to boast about, you know?
Yeah.
Now, he evolved
rather quickly into the style that first Tiki News to, like, when he started doing what was you would see, like, Shag art, which you recognize. It seemed to me it was pretty quick.
Right.
Yeah, the first Tiki News is when Otto would put them out. And there was no internet then. It's hard to... no internet... If you wanted to get something from, for instance, when I met Sven, he wanted copies of all my matchbooks because there was only so many. And I went to Kinko's with all my matchbooks and anything paper, any ephemera.
Right.
And the girl there goes, I can't do that. So why not? She goes, it's copyrighted.
Right.
She's like, what? It's 50 years old. And she wouldn't copy them.
Yeah.
So I had to go to the black and white one, copy them, and send them to Sven.
Right.
It was like, that's how difficult it was just to even get a copy of something. Now you take all of this so for granted. You got your phone. You have the world at your fingertips. You can take pictures. You can do whatever you want. Send videos. Back then, everything was an effort. I mean, I had to mail it to them.
That's funny. You know?
There was no internet. So when Otto's Tiki News would come, it was infrequently, but it was like once a month, once every 6 weeks, whatever. It was just like... You just knew what other people in the world were thinking.
It was
like suddenly this circle had gone from 7-8 people to 20 to 100 to...
How did that feel for you? Because for a long time, it was just you and Mark.
I didn't think about it. It was really exciting because I was finding places I'd never heard of. And now I had a context for what this thing was that had happened. With him... We're wandering around, we were just driving around. It wasn't Tiki we were looking for per se, you know, like the Kapu Kai when we found that. We were just driving. We ended up on Route 66.
Yeah.
We were just following the cool buildings.
Yeah.
And then,
how did you get that Kapu Kai Tiki?
Well, so we went up there. I'll tell you that story. Mark and I, in the 80s, whatever, we took off. We're driving around. We end up in front of it. And that's when the steel plant had gone out of business up in Fontana. So that whole area was just depressed.
Oh, I forgot about that steel.
Yeah.
That steel manufacturer. Yeah.
So it's like the only stuff that's open is liquor store, porno shop, thrift shop, liquor store, porno. It was like just creepy. And we pull up to what the Kapu Kai is, and I thought it was a supermarket. It was that big. I thought, what is this? Because there was no tikis on the outside.
Right.
There was A-frames. There was the waterfall stuff was still left. We're looking inside. We could see there was something carved. We couldn't quite make it out. I had no idea.
I think I saw pictures of some of this online. There was pictures with Jeff Berry walking through it, right?
And you're getting ahead of my story.
Oh, okay. So, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
All right. Go ahead.
Quite all right. So whatever. We never went back there. I just forgot about it. So when we met Sven, what is that? Oh, the Kapu Kai was outfitted by Oceanic Arts and blah, blah, blah. It's like, this guy knows everything. And they had done an urban archaeology expedition into there. He, Sven, John English, Chris Nichols, and Jeff broke in there. took pictures of what was left. Each one of them posed next to one of the tikis, those four.
Right.
The Milan Guanaco tikis. All right. Now segue to, I don't know, late 90s. I get an email from a friend, now he's passed away, but then later he became a friend. He said, and again, Truce and I were going up there. It was still boarded up. Nothing had happened. And he writes and says, I got this 14-foot tiki. He goes, do you want to trade for it? I can't stand it up in my yard. Because he lived at the bottom of the Cajon Pass.
Okay.
And I write him back. I said, that wouldn't happen to be from the Kapu Kai, would it?
Yeah.
And he said I freaked him out when I told him that. Because that's
what
was
really?
Fun. And whatever. We made a trade. I traded him a couple of small tikis. He traded me the big one. I then built the big hut in the back mm-hmm. to contain it. Truce and I got married in there. And then Jeff married us.
I didn't know. I knew that you guys got married in there, but I didn't know that it was Jeff that married
you. It was Jeff, yeah. And he, you know, we had the ceremony. We drank the Okalejo, and that's where we got married. 2, 3, 4 years goes by. Sven says, oh, I dug up these old pictures from we did the expedition to Kapu Kai. And there's Jeff standing next to my tiki.
How cool is that?
How weird is that?
Yeah. Yeah, it is weird too. But I mean that it's – and he married you
yeah.
under that tiki.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's pretty crazy.
Unbelievable.
So do you know what happened to the rest of the tikis that
were
in the
No, they were gone. He said he was on his way to work, couldn't stop, sent his wife out there. There was only – by then there was four. They knocked them down with bulldozers and just piled them up out front. They were charging whatever, $50, $100 each.
Oh, wow.
And he couldn't stop, went to work, called his wife. She went there. There was only two left. She got that one, and he went and picked it up, and it laid in his driveway forever. And then we did our thing.
Wow.
And, yeah, it was just like that. I mean, even earlier you asked, was there someplace that I couldn't get all the stuff out of it? And that would be like the tikis, Danny Balls' place. When we went in there, I mean, he had that huge tiki that's in the Book of Tiki, that 20-something foot thing.
Right.
It was there. He wanted $1,500 for it. And I didn't have $1,500, and nor did I have a crane to, you know, put that thing on a truck and bring it
right.
here. I mean,
right.
it was just crazy, you know, that it was just nuts. They'd had a flood the night before. It was mud
yeah.
all over everything,
yeah.
and he was quite a character.
Yeah. That's a place that I wish I had seen before it closed down. You know, I drove past there on the way here.
Yeah.
Every time I go down the 15, I still look at
yeah.
it. You know, like I'm going to see something.
Yeah, you think, yeah,
you know,
maybe the gate will be open.
Yeah, well, you know, there was one time coming home from Tiki Oasis a few years ago. I drove up to the gate. It was locked. And so I parked my car like right in front of the gate and got out and started taking pictures, you know, just of the gate. About 10 minutes later, a guy drives up in a pickup truck and he looks at me like, hey, can I help you guys? Because I was with a buddy. And I said, oh, yeah, I'm just taking pictures because of, you know, just historical stuff. And he goes, what are you talking about? And I happened to have a Book of Tiki
uh-huh.
in the back seat. And I pulled it out and I showed him pictures. And I said, this used to be the tikis.
Uh-huh.
And I explained to him how it started in Monterey Park and then it made its way here to Elsinore and blah, 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 blah. And I showed him like the
uh-huh.
the artificial caves and the lava and all that kind of stuff, right? And he said, oh yeah, some of that's still here.
Yeah.
And I said, oh really? And I said, can I see it? And he goes, when we open. Then
yeah.
he went in and locked the gate behind me. And then I waited and I came back later on and then I jumped in this one area. Well, I shouldn't say I did. A buddy of mine, Steve Huffman, jumped in behind a fence, and there was an old building there that you could see the faded paint on the eaves
yeah.
that had like the tap patterns and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, you could see Oceanic Arts trim up there.
Yeah, yeah, and rotted out bamboo
yeah.
and stuff. And then there was a sign that said Headhunters Pro Shop, and it was an old sign that was halfway buried in the dirt.
Wow.
He kind of dug it out and pulled it out, and it was covered in mud
yeah.
and dried leaves and stuff. We took photos of all that stuff. But there was no tikis left. And that particular part of the property, there was a little bit left of that cave structure.
Uh-huh.
But and he started to climb on some of it. And then he climbed off of it. And when he came back over the fence, he said, yeah, it's kind of sketchy. He's like, I felt like
it was
going to collapse. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. But it was still there. And you could still see some of the remains.
Yeah. Know? It's yeah, I've tried to get in there many times. I met the guy that did their graphic design. I thought I'd have it in there. Didn't. Blah, blah, blah. No. I mean, we pulled in there. I went with the kids once in Truce.
Yeah.
And it was on a Saturday where they were open for their paintball thing.
Right.
We pulled in. And oh my God, it's like you went, just drove into Afghanistan. It's
yeah,
like
really.
Everybody's in camo,
right.
Heavily armed, and they all just like turn around to look at you, and you're like,
right.
I think I'll put the car in reverse.
And they have these faux abandoned structures that people hide into when they play mm-hmm. their paintball games. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I shudder to, there's another place, I shudder to think, you know, if I had seen what it was like before it, I saw it today, I'd probably feel a lot worse about it, but I never did get to see it.
Yeah, I only have the most abstract memory just seeing it from the freeway and all the photos and meeting him, of course. But by the time we met him, I mean, it was like that scene in, I don't know if you've seen Apocalypse Now, if you see the editor's cut.
I have not.
They had built this set, I think it was in the Philippines, and it all got knocked down by a typhoon.
Okay.
So they spent all this money and it was just a wreck. So they tried to make it work. It didn't. It looked just like that. It was just crap was laying everywhere. There was mud everywhere. It was just a mess. And he was just trying to make whatever kind of money he could off of what he had left.
So you don't know what happened to most of that stuff then?
No, Sven and those guys went on the first tour. I went later with my brother and some friends. And we were inside. He locked the gate behind us. And then people just kept pulling up. It was something was going on. And he kept asking, do you know him? I go, no. You know them? No. You know? And it's Lake Elsinore, you know? It's kind of...
Right, yeah.
And then that was 20 years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, at that time it was a lot more sketchy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He had a pickup truck. Some kid took off in it, went out the other gate. And then so it's time for us to leave with all our stuff that we got. And he says, where's the lock? The key to the lock, the padlock that he locked us in with. And he's like, oh, damn it, I left it in the truck. And he was so pissed off. He had to take a $15 lock and bust it with a hammer. He was so angry. But it was just surreal. And plus, he knew the whole backstory of what happened to this guy. So there was that, you know, he achieved this crazy success. And he was even showing us that. He had this crazy ornate Rococo phone, this white thing on a pedestal. And he's like playing it all up like, oh, sure, Ford Motor Company, 10,000 people tonight, no problem. It's like doing this whole thing for us.
Right.
And yeah, that's about where he was at that time. I mean, he was top of the world. And then to this, it's like this just standing in mud.
Yeah, you know, that building that I was telling you about, I had posted pictures on Facebook several years, and I wrote a little thing about our experience in kind of navigating that building. And on the second floor, there was an apartment of this of this building. And according to Sven, this guy Danny Balls, the owner, had gotten a divorce, and he ended up living on that property in that apartment.
At one end of the property.
Yeah, one end of the property while his ex-wife lived at the other end.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's that kind of character. I mean, it was just bigger than life.
Yeah.
But, then here you are. You're at the end of it, the end of the line for that part of his life, and it was just surreal.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, before we wrap up, what is the future of Tiki Bosco?
That's a good question. If you find out, let me know. I don't know. Right now is a very... I don't want to say I've caught my second wind, because this has already happened to me 2-3 times before. You know, you've been doing it. It seems like the popularity kind of falls off. It picks up again, and you're doing something even bigger than the last time.
Right.
And this has already happened to me a few times. And I didn't think it was going to be anything like it ended up becoming. And each time I thought, well, that's the end of that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So when you think that it's starting to wrap up, are you thinking of any kind of alternate?
Well, I'm always working on my other work, and the wood carving thing, I mean, it's pretty flexible. I can carve anything. I mean, there's like that eagle on the front of the house.
Sure.
I mean, it doesn't have to be tiki, but this last, whatever you want to call it, change seems different to me.
Okay.
And it seems more, I don't want to say mainstream, but that kind of is what it is. It's become like, tiki seems to have become like a thing like Harley's.
Okay.
Like, like, you know, James Dean. It's like become this American thing now.
Yeah.
It's not, it doesn't seem like it's outside like it was with Freaky before. Because in the old days, you know.
It's less of a subculture.
Yeah, in the old days, there was no girls. It was just guys.
I remember.
And then all of a sudden, like two or three of them. And then, you know, to now what it is now, you got these pinups and, you know, it's just like over the top. It's just regular kind of mainstream. It's kind of accepted now. I can't quite put my finger on it. Before, there was always some segment of people that would come, like the wives in particular, that would be freaked out by it. They just didn't know what to make of this.
And you've had a busy year.
Busy 2 years, yeah.
Busy 2 years, yeah. As busy as you've ever been before?
Ever. Yeah, I had to hire we were just swamped.
Yeah.
You know, and then when you're thinking of work like that, it's a completely different thing than when you're working alone or with one other person.
Sure.
You know, it's like more like a military thing. You have to line up. This person has to be here. That has to be there. It's more.
It's turning into that Witco factory we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we were ready for it. And we, it was just, I couldn't be prouder. I mean, some of the stuff, it's just, I think the work is getting better.
Yeah.
And we have a whole bunch of mugs we're going to do again soon. Hopefully that will become a regular thing again. And I don't know. I mean, I always think I know what's coming, and I just have no idea, you know. But
so the answer is you're just kind of going with the flow.
I think there's probably going to be more tiki.
Yeah. Okay, good. Good.
Yeah, and before, I was always kind of, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
But now I see it just seems to be – it's just more ramped up. I can't quite put it. It's just more accepted. It's more of a budget now.
Right, right. Well, for those of us that want to find your work, where can we find your work online?
TikiBosco.com with a K, Tiki Bosco, B-O-S-K-O. Tiki Bosco on Instagram, on Facebook.
Cool. So if you guys out there are interested in picking up some cool mugs and some cool art, maybe a tiki carving or so, check out TikiBosco.com or find him on Facebook or Instagram at Tiki Bosco. And if you're going to be at Tiki Oasis, Tiki Bosco will be there selling tikis, mugs.
Say hello.
Say hello. Stop by. You're normally in the
inside.
The inside conference room, just across from the check-in.
Correct. Yes.
Check-in table, yeah. Right?
Right.
I don't know the name of that room, so.
I don't either.
Yeah, so that's so wherever you guys check in for Tiki Oasis, right across from there is a vending room.
In the air conditioning, not outside.
Right, right. So stop by and say hi. I believe you'll be sharing a booth with Tiki Diablo.
And don't mistake me for Tiki Diablo.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time out today and allowing me to interview you for this podcast. And thanks for showing me around. This is not my first time here.
No, no.
But I always love coming by and checking out what you're doing here. And those of you listeners that are out there, if you have a question, comment, or just want to leave a shout out, stop by our Inside the Desert Oasis Room group page on Facebook or find us on Instagram at Polynesian Pop. Thanks for listening. Cheers and aloha.